Please help me welcome Wiley Catch.
Okay, Wally, first thing I have to ask you about. First came A Land More Kind Than Home, then This Dark Road to Mercy. What's with the titles?
Well, I like titles that nobody can remember the name of, so they have to they have to remember my name. So hopefully my name will be around longer than my titles will be. But, you know, the title of the first book, A Land More Kind Than Home, came from, well, the original title of the first book was The Rain Barrel. But nobody from my editor to my agent to marketing to sales to, you know, nobody liked that title ever because they felt like it was kind of a prop. Like once you got to the point in the novel where you see the rain barrel, readers might think, oh, well, that was simple or that was, you know, it'd be like calling, you know, the book like, you know, Moby Dick, calling it The Ship or something, you know. Or Moby Dick, I guess. And so we looked for titles in works by other Southern writers. And A Land More Kind Than Home comes from Thomas Wolfe's You Can't Go Home Again, which is the last novel that was published under his name. It was published after he died. And I was a big Thomas Wolfe fan. The novel had kind of a biblical resonance, tones of salvation and deliverance and the kind of things we wanted. And so with the second novel, the working title for this novel about a washed-up baseball player kidnaps his two little girls from a foster home, the working title was Stealing Home. And that was really cheesy and obvious. And nobody liked that one either. And it was,
there was a movie with that title.
Yeah, there was a movie with Mark Harmon and Jodie Foster in the 80s called Stealing Home, and also a biography on Jackie Robinson called Stealing Home. And so I went again to look at work by Southern writers, and I came across this quote from a novella by Carson McCullers called The Ballad of the Sad Cafe. And there's a line in that novel that references two orphans, and it said that they were left to the mercies of the town. Mm-hmm. And the word mercy just stuck with me. And this is a road novel in many ways, so it felt like a road to mercy, but I wanted it to be specific. So This Dark Road to Mercy felt felt right. That was a very long answer, but that's the story behind the titles.
Okay. Well, as you said, your novel starts off in Gastonia. Set the scene a little bit for folks who aren't familiar with the city.
Sure. Gastonia is a town just about 30 minutes west of Charlotte, about an hour and a half east of Asheville. It's an old mill town. You probably wouldn't notice it too much if you were just driving on I-85 or looping around it in one way or another. But that's where I grew up. It's kind of become a suburb of Charlotte, probably to its benefit in many ways. But, you know, it was a great place to grow up. We had, you know, a house in a neighborhood that was surrounded by woods, and we lived close to our elementary school, so we got to ride our bikes home every day and play in the woods and do incredibly dangerous things that our parents never found out about, you know. But it was a great place to grow up, but I grew up going to the minor league ballpark to see the Gastonia Rangers, who were the farm team for the Texas Rangers. And I saw a lot of, well, I didn't know it at the time, no one did, but Sammy Sosa came through Gastonia. Pudge Rodriguez came through Gastonia, who eventually won a World Series with the Tigers, I think, or the Marlins maybe. He came through Gastonia. And so when I decided I was going to write a second novel after no one would buy A Land More Kind Than Home and publish it, I went back to Gastonia and remembered the Rangers, and I remembered all these stories that I'd heard about, you know, these two little girls who were murdered in my hometown. The theme of baseball, the theme of fathers and daughters and all this stuff kind of came back to me.
Yeah. You also had, there's one other event that has a little resonance that was about the same time, the 97 Loomis Fargo armored car robbery.
That definitely happened.
Where the guys basically wound up keeping the money in a storage locker.
Yeah, but do y'all remember that, the Loomis Fargo in Gastonia? Are y'all from Gastonia? Yeah.
I was registered there. I worked some of those cases.
Oh, wow. Well, this guy might know more than me, but in 1997, this guy who worked for the Loomis Fargo warehouse in Charlotte was there with the trainee, and he sent the trainee home early, stayed behind, and loaded like $21 million into an armored car and just drove it away. And he thought that he was working with this woman he was in love with who worked with him at the warehouse, but it turns out she'd gotten all these other people involved, and he didn't know that. And so when he drove away, he was shocked when outside the warehouse there were a dozen or so people waiting for him. And they flew him down to Cancun with, you know, maybe $25,000 like strapped to his body. And then for the next probably 6 months, they tried to hire people to go down to Cancun to kill him so they could keep all of this money. And they paid cash for a mansion in this gated neighborhood. They laundered money by giving friends $10,000 and then having their friends write them a check for $5,000. Some of these friends were reporting that as income on their taxes. They bought a furniture store for cash in downtown Gastonia. They went to the bank and asked the bank tellers questions like, how much money can I deposit before you contact the FBI?
That would tend to make people suspicious.
It did.
Let's just say that the bad guys in your novel are a good deal more sophisticated.
Certainly,
and probably a good deal nastier than the actual.
My novel has nothing to do with the bank heist, but you know, it's definitely an interesting story, bank heist. And there's a great book called Heist that's written by a reporter from the Charlotte Observer that you can get and read all about the bank heist. It is. Too good to be true.
Well, short story long, Wade, our washed-up baseball player, is not involved in this case. But let's just say that he has a certain windfall at the bad guy's expense, and he suddenly has a whole big sack of money he's running around with.
Mm-hmm.
And he signed away custody of his two little girls long before their mother died. He didn't realize that's what he was doing, but he has no further claim on them. Mm-hmm. So basically, he sort of hijacks the two little girls, Easter and Ruby, out of the foster home, and they hit the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like everybody from the Charlotte area, the first thing they do is drive to Myrtle Beach.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was a kid, there was really nowhere more exciting you could go. It was like Myrtle Beach or Disney World, and they don't have the gas to get to Disney World, so they head for Myrtle Beach, but. You know, it was important to me when I was writing this book to write about and think about places that I remember distinctly. You know, everything that I've ever written about, either in a book or a short story, has been a place that I know distinctly, that I know or remember very, very well.
You knew Madison County, which is where your Kindness home is set up, because you studied near there, you hiked and camped there. Can you imagine writing about some place that you don't know, like sitting down and inventing Middle Earth or something like that?
I can't imagine doing something like that. As a matter of fact, part of this book, This Dark Road to Mercy, takes place in St. Louis on the day that Mark McGuire ties Roger Maris's record, and I'd never been to St. Louis. And like all good writers, I researched St. Louis on Google, and got on the Google Earth feature and virtually drove into St. Louis and looked around going across the bridge. Okay, you can see the arch off to the right. If he was parking, they probably would park under this overpass because it's close to the stadium. Somebody would be charging them to park there. There's this parking deck. And so simple things like that I felt comfortable representing, but I was still terrified about getting the stadium wrong, about getting the weather on that day wrong. My wife, who is like, she wouldn't admit this, but she's like CSI when it comes to the internet. She found a video of McGuire tying Maris's record, because there's all kind of video of him breaking the record. But nobody now cares about him tying the record. But she found video of that. So I got to kind of relive that moment by relying on Google and by watching these videos. But ironically, I went to St. Louis on my book tour. I was there last week, actually, on Tuesday or Wednesday, and I had an interview on the Fox affiliate. I got interviewed. If y'all are baseball fans, you know Jack Buck called the St. Louis Cardinal games. His son, Joe Buck, does like all the Cowboys games and the Super Bowl and the World Series. Joe Buck's sister interviewed me on the Fox affiliate. I'm like, my book's set in St. Louis. I got a Buck interviewing me. I had two people come to my event that night. And so I thought, maybe I got St. Louis wrong. And they all read it, and they're voicing their frustration.
Sounds like St. Louis Blues.
We did. Yeah, but we went, instead of having an event, we had dinner together. So that ended up being fun.
That's
so
good. All right. Well, we got a few more we got a few more people for you tonight. Does anyone have a question for Wiley? Yes, ma'am.
Have it's been burning, and I've almost like tried to email you or anything. Has a landlord kind of have you had movie options?
No, we haven't sold the option for that one yet. People have sniffed around it, but nobody's made an official offer. Are you making a pitch? Yeah.
I mean, I cast it in my head.
Make a phone call. Get Screen Gems on the phone.
Saw you raise your hand, ma'am.
Yes. I was very interested in how you came up with some of your ideas for some of the violence in the book. And I just heard you say that you don't write about things that you haven't had experience with. So.
Well, I have killed several people purely for research purposes. You can get a dispensation from the Authors Guild to do that. But, you know, I write about places that I know, not necessarily circumstances that I know. And these people that are in my books, I say that like I've got a lot of books, these people who are in my two books are people who are very different from me. So, for example, in my first novel, one of my narrators is an 81-year-old woman. Well, that's basically the exact opposite of me. In this new book, one of the narrators is a 12-year-old girl. And it's easier for me to write about those characters who are in circumstances that are so opposite of mine than it would be to write about a 36-year-old white guy in North Carolina who's a writer. That would be really difficult for me because I would try to protect something of myself. Whereas these characters, I can let them live fully on the page, because I'm not withholding anything in creating them. But things like violence and these circumstances, I actually wrote an essay today for a website that I'm doing an interview with tomorrow. And the essay is on creating character over plot. Some writers or some movie producers maybe, they'll start with an idea and they'll say, a spaceship lands on Mars and this happens. Well, that's a plot thing. My idea may be something along the lines of an astronaut whose family has left him, whose wife has recently died, sends himself to Mars on purpose, right? So it starts with that character who has this conflict in his life. And so when I create these characters, this character like Adelaide, that 81-year-old woman, I know her. I know her life. I know how she sees the world. And once I believe in her, I can imagine interesting things happening to her. And maybe not, violence won't happen to her. Maybe it'll happen to some of the other characters. But this only happens because I believe in these people, not because I necessarily set out thinking like, I'm going to make sure this character's knocked off by the end of the book. You know, the circumstances just kind of warrant that, you know, because I really try to create characters that I believe in and that I care about. And I want to spend the amount of time with that it takes to write a novel, you know, because it takes me about 2.5 years to write a novel. And if I was a plot guy, it may take me 6 months. If I'm James Patterson, it takes me 3 to 4 days. Because he has somebody writing them for him, primarily. But I try to create interesting people that maybe if they're interesting enough, something interesting will happen to them. They'll make a wrong decision. They'll have to suffer somebody else's wrong decision. And so these circumstances aren't necessarily circumstances that I've experienced, but the things that I can imagine happening, because I've heard of them happening to somebody, yeah, perhaps.
Well, let me follow up on that, because she raises a good one. You're not Cormac McCarthy quite yet. No cannibalism yet.
No.
But your novels definitely have this dark vein running through them. You have the characters like the preacher in Land More Kind Than Home, and then in The Stark Road, you've got the character Pruitt, the hitman, mm-hmm. the ex-ball player who blames poor Wade, the hero, for ruining his career, and therefore is planning all sorts of very interesting things he plans to do once he catches him. I mean, where does that come from? Do you like, you don't torture puppies or anything, do you? I mean,
not anymore. But
I left myself open.
Okay. You know, I don't know, you know, with Land More Kind, I have this preacher who will go to great lengths to protect not only himself physically, but also this aura that he's created around himself. Mm-hmm. And we see people do that all the time, you know. I don't know that he does anything necessarily more evil than, say, what Lance Armstrong did to people who disagreed with him when they outed him as being a doper mm-hmm. in yeah. the Tour de France, or as egregious as what politicians do to their mistresses, or what, you know, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker did to their followers. And I grew up in the 80s watching things like that happen and watching people rush to protect these people who were awful, awful human mm-hmm. beings. And I just remember those things. And I think, you know, if somebody doesn't have a conscience, what are they willing to do to protect themselves? Mm-hmm. Or if somebody feels like they've been damaged or injured enough, like Pruitt in my new novel, what lengths will they go to exercise some kind of revenge? And I'm really interested in that. You know, it's problematic for me because in the new book, Pruitt's a narrator. And so I have him saying, I am going to go and do this horrible thing, you know, and it was hard for me to imagine those words being in my mouth. And so I read novels that have villains as first person narrators. And one of them, probably the best one, is American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. I don't know how many of you have read that novel or seen that movie, but it's set in the 1980s and it's about this Wall Street stock trader who is a bloodthirsty, homicidal maniac. And about halfway through the book, you're kind of rooting for him mm-hmm. not to get caught because you've come to identify very uncomfortably with this narrator. Mm-hmm. And I wanted the readers to feel that way about Pruitt, to feel maybe they understand him a little bit, you know, the circumstances of his childhood, maybe this injustice that he feels that Wade has done to him. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there's a little bit of discomfort in saying, man, I kind of get it. You know, I kind of understand, mm-hmm. you know, because in American Psycho, the message that's sent is this guy lives in a false world of Ralph Lauren suits and Gucci handbags and these business cards. And he's jealous of everybody's business card. So nothing has any value. And so when he murders people, they don't have value to him. Mm-hmm. And he's reflecting the culture he's part of. And you kind of understand, you know, you kind of understand how someone who lives in that world could see that world that way. And I think that calling attention to the dark stuff asks us to remember the light stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. More questions for Wiley. Yes, ma'am.
I have something. I really liked the guardian ad litem guy, the rogue detective, you know, always on the verge of not doing things, or a little past the verge of not doing things the way they should have been done. But he really cared about the girls. But that last scene, I didn't understand him at all when he took the girls to the park.
Mm-hmm. Don't give it away too much.
It was almost cruel.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where that setup came from.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have imagined that he would have done that.
I know, and I wanted you to feel that way. I wanted you to feel that you had spent a lot of time with this guy and that you knew him, but maybe you didn't in the end. And not that he was purposely manipulating you or knowingly doing what he thought was the wrong thing. I really think that he's in a position, because of his past as a police detective and because of his damaged relationship with his daughter, where he really doesn't know what the right thing to do is anymore. There's the law, which we're told you've got to follow the law, but the law is not always the most moral thing. It's not always black and white. Sometimes it's gray. And this is one of those situations that's gray. And I wanted the reader to wonder what he was going to do in that situation and maybe be surprised either way, one way or another. I think somebody else in your position would be surprised if he'd done something else. And I wanted it to feel that way. You know, I wanted the reader to be, not disappointed, but uncomfortable and questioning why he did what he did. Because that's when you got a real character. That's when you've got somebody that feels real on the page that can surprise you, you know. Not with an aha moment like O. Henry, where she cuts her hair and he buys her a brush, you know. Not that kind of aha, that kind of surprise. But, I mean, how many times in our lives do we say, I can't believe you've done this to me? You know, we say that every year to somebody. And then we say it the next year. We're like, I can't believe I'm saying this again. I can't believe you've done this to me. You know, so I don't know.
Well, I have to say that you've got that detective stuff. You wanted to write one of those kind of books because that guy acted so much like some of my favorite rogue detectives.
Who were some of your favorites?
Hieronymus Bosch.
Who's that from?
Michael Connelly.
Okay. Are you a James Lee Burke fan with Dave Robichaux? Well, the detective novels are very, very particular, and I don't mean particular, I mean distinct. They're very distinct, and I don't feel like I would be able to write the kind of novel that keeps the reader in the dark, you know, like a mystery novel or a real detective novel where something's obscured from the reader and they're reading to find out who committed the murder or how somebody got to be in the position they're in. I don't feel like I'm technically gifted as a thinker to be able to predict those moves in advance. Like the movie Clue, I can't imagine how you even sit down to start intertwining all of those various things. So I like to think about novels and make them mysterious in another way, in that the reader knows everything. The reader knows everything. But the characters only know certain things. And so the joy, hopefully, in a book like mine is the reader is reading to see when all that knowledge comes together. And any one character has the full knowledge the reader has. Because that's when something's bad or something good is going to happen. So in my first book, Jess knows this horrible truth about what happened in the church to his brother. And the reader is reading that thinking, when is Jess going to share this? When Jess shares this, that's when something bad's going to happen. And I didn't want the reader not to know what happened in the church and then keep that from the reader for 200 pages. I wanted them to know and have that just burn, you know, and burn down. So those detective novels are tricky. They're fun to read, but I can't imagine how hard they are to write. I can't even begin to imagine that.
So I, yes, sir.
Have you gotten any reaction to the folks in
I tried. I tried to have my release there, but it snowed 2 inches, and it was like the zombie apocalypse. I mean, the city. And I mean, I grew up in Gastonia. You used to snow there, you know, and life went on. Not this night. We were supposed to have a big release at my high school, and we had a local independent store ready to sell. They were bringing like 300 books. We thought we'd have a huge turnout, and it ended up being canceled. And moved to a Books a Million in town, and we still had a pretty good turnout. But everyone I've known who's read it in Gastonia has had fun with it. You know that it's interesting to see a place that you know on the page. You know, Lineberger Park's in it, Tony's Ice Cream is in it, Robinson Elementary's in it, Crowder's Mountain is mentioned. There's a lot of things that are in it, Sims Field. That if you're from Gastonia or you spent time there, you'll recognize these places. And that was really fun for me. You know, it was really fun for me. Because I remember when I was living in Asheville and then I left and went down to Louisiana for graduate school, I could read Look Homeward Angel and read about Eugene Gant walking through this street in Altamont, and I knew which street it was in Asheville. And so when I sat down to read that, it was like I was back in Asheville. And I wanted the reader, even if they were living in Gastonia, to read that and think, I know this place. I can picture this place, you know.
More questions? You mentioned, yes, ma'am.
I was going to say, going back to your character development, I think you've done a good job with your characters.
Thank you.
So much so that I saw keychain fireflies, and I almost bought one for Stump.
That's sweet. That's sweet. Thank you.
I thought it was interesting also your section about how the writer in residence helped you develop the scene, that was the one thing you were lacking.
Mm-hmm.
And how difficult, or well, kind of difficult as you were, that he made you write with the North Carolina background
mm-hmm.
while you were in Louisiana. So mm-hmm. you had to keep picture. And then I liked also from West Virginia that sometimes I see the clouds and they look like mountains to me.
Oh, thank you. Where are you from in West Virginia?
Moundsville.
Okay. Yeah, I know Moundsville. Okay, yeah, Moundsville. Moundsville is a really interesting place in West Virginia. There's a great novel there, set there, called Night of the Hunter, by a writer named Davis Grubb. It was turned into a movie starring Robert Mitchum. The movie is much more famous than the book. But
there was a TV version filmed here back in the 80s with Richard Chamberlain, of all people.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But the novel is fantastic. It is terrifying. The novel is absolutely terrifying, and it's a really well written novel. But, yeah, you mentioned, you know, writing about the place that I was from. I went to Louisiana to study under a writer named Ernest Gaines, and he grew up in Southwest Louisiana, then moved out to California because there were no schools for African-American children after, I guess, like sixth grade. And so when he moved out to California, he realized how homesick he was for Louisiana, so he started writing about it to kind of be back there. And that's one of the reasons that I started writing about North Carolina, you know. I had always written stories and tried to publish stories when I left North Carolina, but they were just kind of these generic, placeless stories where the people just spoke English without any kind of affectation or any kind of rootedness to any place. And so when I went down to Louisiana, I decided, you know, I can set all my stuff in North Carolina, and I can, if I do that, I can make it real because I know what that place is, and I can also go home in a sense. So that was important to me.
I think it comes across as good.
Thank you.
It really helps set scenes.
Thank you.
I have to ask a question now. You've mentioned Thomas Wolfe a couple of times now. Who are some other writers who've had a major impact on you?
Oh gosh, you know. Mostly Southern writers. Ernest Gaines is probably the most direct. Like, I think you can draw the most direct line from his fiction to mine in terms of effect. Like, you can just see it. You know, I can see it. But there's a lot of contemporary writers. And, of course, William Faulkner is kind of like the Southern ghost that hovers over everybody. You know, even if you've never read Faulkner, if you're writing in the South,
what was it,
you've read Faulkner.
Flannery O'Connor called him the Dixie Special, and the rest of us all better get off the track.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and she's another one. You know, I've definitely been affected by Flannery O'Connor, the quirky characters, kind of the violent impulse in fiction, perhaps. But a lot of contemporary writers, too, like Bobby Ann Mason, Lee Smith, Clyde Edgerton, Tom Franklin down in Mississippi. Ron Rash, of course, you know, another North Carolina writer. This is usual suspects. But also, you know, I'm affected by a lot of international literature. Like, I read Anna Karenina for the first time last year, and, I mean, it was just incredible. You know, I mean, it was absolutely incredible. And I've probably spent more time thinking about how that book works than I have any book since I've read it.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell folks what's coming up for you. What's our coming attraction here?
I am working on a new novel. I have two more books under contract with my publisher, and it is set also in Gastonia. This is about the Loray Mill strike in 1929. Loray Mill is a mill that was built in 1900 by two local investors whose names were Love and Gray, and they combined them to get Loray. And around about 1920, it was purchased by a Rhode Island company called Manville Jinks. And they came and instituted a lot of the practices that they had up north. They put a chain link fence around it. They no longer allowed employees to leave the mill to go home and check on their children. Many of the children were being raised by themselves. They didn't have any parents in the house when their parents were at work. They instituted this thing called the stretch out, where they mechanized the labor force and laid off workers So if you're one of the remaining workers, you were responsible for more output and a harder work day, but you made the same amount of money. And so there was this textile workers union called the National Textile Workers Union out of New York City. They were a known communist affiliated labor union, and they wanted to organize a strike in the South. And so this guy named Fred Beale jumped on his motorcycle. He'd grown up in the mills in Massachusetts around Lowell. There's also a Lowell, North Carolina, which is named for Lowell, Massachusetts. He jumped on his motorcycle, rode down to the South, and started looking for a mill where he could organize a strike. And he found Loray, and it was perfect. It was the largest mill in the world. At the time it was built, it had 600,000 square feet under one roof. Mill conditions were deplorable. People were being laid off. And so he organized a strike, and they struck, I believe, in April of 1929. And one night there was a raid at the strikers' headquarters in October, and the local police chief was shot during the raid. And so all of these strikers were arrested and charged with the police chief's murder. And there was also a woman named Ella Mae Wiggins who came down. People don't know if she was from Tennessee or the mountains of North Carolina, but she had come down from the mountains, gone to Cowpens, South Carolina, worked in a mill, and ended up in Gastonia. And by the time she was 29 in 1929, she'd had 9 kids. 4 of them had died from poverty-related illnesses. She had testified in front of Congress about mill conditions in the South. She'd tried to integrate the union with local African Americans. She'd written a bunch of songs that Pete Seeger has recorded, Woody Guthrie's recorded them. And she was leaving a rally in support of these jailed strikers, and somebody shot into the caravan she was in, and she died. And so this novel is about Ella Mae coming down from the mountains of Tennessee and finding her way to North Carolina, to Gastonia, where she's murdered. And it's intercut with the story of her oldest daughter trying to walk from Gastonia back to Tennessee to find her mother's family. And then those two stories are intercut with the story of a contemporary woman who's writing a novel about Ella Mae Wiggins, who's interviewing Ella Mae's daughter in the process of writing this novel. And so we have these this three strands of the story of the Loray Mill strike. So basically my pitch, my elevator pitch, that's the long version of what the novel's about. But it's about a mill strike and how it affects three generations of women in the Deep South.
Mm. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to comment, just to applaud you for doing that novel that you're working on.
Thank you. I grew up in Gastonia, never heard it mentioned until I left. You know, I told somebody in graduate school that I was from Gastonia, and they said, oh, the Loray Mill strike. That's a really famous mill strike. And I was like, Loray Mill? And of course, I did my writer's research and Googled it, and I saw the mill, and I'd always known it as the Firestone plant, because Firestone bought it in 1938, and it had basically been, you know, deserted for quite a while by the time I came along. But it was still there. They put a star on it every year for Christmas. I could see it from the YMCA where we played basketball. So I always knew it was there, but I never knew the story of it. And my parents, my dad's from Shelby, which is 30 minutes from Gastonia, and my mom's from Gastonia, didn't know the story of it either. Mm-hmm. And then it dawned on me, my parents were raised in the 50s, which is the height of McCarthyism. So of course they're not going to hear about this mill strike where communists come down to help a bunch of poor people. I was raised in the 1980s during the Cold War, so of course I'm not going to hear about this mill strike where a bunch of communists try to help poor people. But what's so funny is that the mills were so afraid of communism, but the mills promised a communal utopia. That's how they got people to come down. You know, if you come here and you work, everybody's equal, everybody has a house, everybody's educated, your medical stuff's taken care of, you're not paid in real money, you go to the company store. That's communism, right? And they wanted their own brand of mill communism that nobody from the outside could really influence.
And of course, nearby was Kannapolis, which for years was the largest unincorporated community in the United States, because it didn't need a municipal government, because everything was provided by cannon mills.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a little fiefdom.
Jacqueline Hall wrote a oral history about the mills called Like a Family.
Mm-hmm.
And it recalled the early days when they had like their own baseball teams and mill leagues,
absolutely.
And sometimes even brass bands and stuff.
Yeah, they would really, you know, and I think early on, and maybe even later, maybe in the 50s and 60s, the mill villages kind of regained that sense of community. But during the Depression, I mean, it was terrible.
Yeah, whenever I was a little bit different. My my mother's family came from Gastonia, and I guess my grandparents were sort of on the other side of the picket line. I mean, they were the ones who were getting scared of the communists, and were moved when they brought the effigy of the bloodstained effigy of the chief into the court, police chief into the courtroom and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. It was sort of like, it was almost like the, 1898 in Wilmington. It was talked about, but only in whispers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And not in front of strangers.
Like, for example, nobody was ever charged with Ella May's murder. Nobody was ever convicted of that. Yeah.
And so I imagine it's going to be part of your job to try to get that across of why that is such a hot button and just how, have you thought about how you'll do that?
I don't know. You know, I'm not as quite as interested in, I don't know that I'm so interested in either the evils of capitalism or the evils of communism in terms of being a fiction writer. It's like when I would teach like American literature, we would teach things about, you know, colonization of Native Americans. We'd teach a lot of hot button controversial stuff. But I would always tell the students, you know, we're going to talk about these very controversial things like race and gender and all these issues. And I want y'all to think deeply and broadly, but I don't want you to ever know my opinions on how I vote, perhaps. I want you to know I vote, but I don't want you to know how I vote. I don't want you to be able to tell from how I teach this class how I vote. And I don't think that I would want someone to know that based on what I'm writing so much. And so I think when I write, I try to take the characters based on their own experience. You know, I'm not going to be the muckraker journalist or journalist turned fiction writer that somebody from, you know, the late 20th century or, you know, the late 19th century is going to be, or the early 20th century, where I'm going to write about, you know, the Japanese coming to San Francisco or industrial powers in Chicago or anything like that, you know. Not that I don't think that's not important, because I think it is. I just don't think that I'm so interested in doing that. So when I write this novel, I think I'll write it about Ella May and the things that she experienced, at least my version of Ella May and the things she experienced, and let the readers kind of draw their own conclusions about how they see that, you know. And I still don't know exactly what the portraits are going to be in the novel. You know, she may make friends with a woman who's on the other side of the picket line. I don't know. You know, I'm as interested as anybody could be to read it. You know, I haven't finished it yet, so we'll see.
Okay. Do you have a tentative title or?
No, I don't. I think I'll call it The Rain Barrel. Okay. Stealing Home in the Rain Barrel. Well.
Okay. yes, Ms. Graham.
I don't know if I asked you this before. Are you kidding, W.J. Cash?
No, I'm not. W.J. Cash is a guy who wrote this iconic philosophical treatise called The Mind of the South. And for a long time, it was kind of the progressive answer to the agrarians. And the agrarians were these guys from Nashville who believe that we just, if we hold fast.
Who wrote I'll Take My Stand.
Yeah, they wrote this collection of essays called I'll Take My Stand. If we just hold fast to the land and the old traditions of the old South, we'll be okay.
Robert Penn Warren started out with them, although he later migrated.
Yeah, Robert Penn Warren, Clint Brooks, and W.J. Cash came along and said, the South's changing. A lot of this ideology that the new South is built on is not real. You know, these guys weren't what you think they were, and we have these issues of slavery and class and labor and all this stuff.
Role of violence and all that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he is from Boiling Springs, North Carolina, and my dad's family, the Cashes, are from Shelby, and they're literally 5 miles apart. And my cousin, who's like a crack genealogist, can find no connection between the two families. Yeah, it's so bizarre. I got a call from the president of the North Carolina Hall of Fame, the Literary Hall of Fame, several years ago, and I was like, this call's a little premature. And he said, I'm actually calling about W.J. Cash to see if you will come represent the family. We're going to induct him into the North Carolina Literary Hall of Fame. And I said, will y'all pay for me to come? Because I was living in West Virginia, I don't have any money. And I said, will you pay for me to come? He's like, no, but we got a very nice gift bag for the, you know, the inductees, and you'll get a certificate. And I said, well, let me check with my cousin. And I called my cousin, and he said, there's no link. And I told the guy, I said, I can't come. There's no link. And he said, will you just come anyway? Just tell people there is. So,
although, yeah. although Cash is buried in Shelby, not too far from Thomas Dixon.
I know. Thomas Dixon, if y'all know Birth of a Nation.
He wrote the novel, The Klansman, mm-hmm. on which the movie was based.
Yeah.
He also wrote a book called The Leopard Spots, which is sort of the Klan version of what happened in Wilmington in 1898.
Yeah.
Not exactly PC to put
no.
To be wise possible. Any more questions for Wiley?
I just had another statement. I just really love the quote from Flannery O'Connor that you used.
Oh, thank you. I like that one too.
About home, and that home is really within all of us.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
One last question. We were talking a little bit. Tell me just a little bit about this first edition project you have going on the side.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that, Ben. A friend of mine in town here, he's actually a good friend of my brother's, is a comedian, and he has spent his adult life working with adults with special needs. And he has, in the past several months, developed a case of melanoma. It started in his neck, moved to his hip, now it's settled in his spine. And he and his wife have two young boys, and they've been burning up I-40, driving back and forth to Chapel Hill for special treatments. He had catastrophic insurance, so his deductible is astronomical. And they've been having several fundraisers in town trying to raise money to help his medical bills and also help out with the kids and stuff. And so I thought something kind of fun that I could do would be to reach out to writers I know and ask them to contribute signed first run, first print editions of their novels that I can auction. And I just got inundated with books. I've got first editions by Pat Conroy, Amy Tan, Lee Smith, Jill McCorkle, Clyde Edgerton, Ben Fountain, major award winners, all first run, first edition, signed. I've got the notes they sent me, all this stuff, and I'm going to auction it off at some point in the very near future. I ran the numbers last night, and I have about, based on collectors' websites and the condition of the books, about over $2,000 worth of stuff. So that's where I think the bidding will start, about $2,000. So I'm hoping some benevolent soul is going to swoop in.
How can we find out when this big sale is going to come?
I'll probably put it on my Facebook author page and Twitter, and hopefully rely on folks in the community to get the word out. But I'd like to have it up and running a week from today, actually. I've got a few more authors who are trying to get books to me. I think I'm going to probably put it on eBay or something like that.
Donna Tartt,
I wish, yeah.
It takes you about 10 years.
One about every 10 years. Yeah.
She's about one-fifth. About one-fifth as productive as Wiley here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she has shorter titles.
So I'm hoping to have it up a week from today. So I've got about 30. I've got 28 books right now. For example, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk by Ben Fountain. Won the National Book Critics Circle. Mm-hmm. I've got that in his first collection of short stories, which is worth about $200 alone. Mm-hmm. So,
if
anybody's interested, send them my way.
All right. Any more questions? Yes, sir.
Just to go back when you were talking a little bit a while ago about dark and light, I'm just about focusing on talking a little bit more about the dark for purpose of
contrast.
Right, just interested in hearing you talk a little bit more about that.
About writing about the light and the dark. You know, people have asked me, like, why are your books so dark? And I don't think they are. You know, I don't think that, you know, there's really not a whole lot of dark in our lives, to be honest. You know, we're all pretty lucky to be in this country to begin with. And there's a saying, if you're breathing, there's more right with you than there is wrong with you, right? So I think that when we have these moments of darkness, the reason we remember them so well is because they're contrasted against all of this light, all of these wonderful things we have in our lives. That's why deaths affect us so greatly, because life is so wonderful. That's why loss affects us so greatly, because the having is what's so intoxicating. And so in my books, I can't have despair the entire time, but I can't have joy the entire time. Because if you just have joy the entire time, it's like getting a massage where they only focus on your shoulders. It'll feel good for 5 minutes, and then after 10 minutes, it'll kind of hurt. Then after 20, it'll just go numb, and you won't feel it anymore. So if you just have joy, then you don't appreciate it. You don't know what it is not to have it, you know. And so that's why I feel like when there are these dark moments in my book, they're there to give a sense of that balance, maybe.
All right. Well, thank you, Wiley. I think we can persuade him to, if you have any more questions or comments or things you wanted to ask him, I think we can persuade him stay around for a few minutes, maybe sign
some books. Absolutely.
And I'd like to invite you to come back again in April. Our guest will be Celia Rivenbark, who will be talking about her etiquette guide, Rude Bitches Make Me Tired. Starting next week.
Friday.
It's Friday.
The theater version.
Well, that's right. Theater Now. Theater Now will be showing a staged version of this very book. With a cast of four ladies, four all being Celia at different times. So, and I think Celia will have a little bit part in there. So anyway, that's coming up, but that'll cost you some money for dinner. When we come back in April, we'll be free. So thank y'all very much. Have a pleasant evening. Thank you for coming out this week.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.